All right, guys, welcome to the Search and Seizure Show. This is where I answer your questions live. I have a printout of some questions, but I also have a lot of people here that probably have questions of their own, right? And you can see from the background, I'm a big Second Amendment advocate. So this is why I love Governor Newsom in California, because nobody's more of a Second Amendment advocate than him. All right, so what do you guys got? Steven, you got a question for me? No video. There's no video. Just microphone. So, Stephen Napardi, do you want to ask a question? Okay. While you figure that out. Let me go with the first one, okay? I have a list of questions here. Mike, you have to answer on the phone, on the mic. You want to do the mic? Mike? Come on, get you mic. Let's get you mic'd up. You good? Nah, no mic. What kind of operation are you running around there? No microphone. What do you want, a compact computer? So Mike is actually going to try to test me. He says, how many in which circuits is it currently clearly established law that an officer uses objectively unreasonable force in shooting an armed suspect who is not pointing a gun at an officer or other person? I don't know, because I'm not the use of force expert. You are, Mike. You want to get on that mic and explain yourself? Okay. Robert, do you want to call? We gotta. I don't know if I want to get you on the microphone, Mike. Brave. I don't want you showing me up and doing your own webinars and taking my customers. All right. Search and seizure only. No use of force. All right. So unless you can get on the mic, we're going to continue here. You want to bring Mike Brave on? All right, Mike, I got a request for you. Okay, I'm going to try to turn you. Let's see if we can bring Mike on.
Great evening.
How are you doing, my friend? You know, excellent, just so you guys know.
Perfect and positive in every way, and yourself.
Yeah, that's the thing about Mike. When you receive emails from Mike, and I don't know if you have in your chat function, if you want to, you know, add your, you know, I don't know, like subscription. I know you have these emails. That's for a lot of officers, right? They can, are they encouraged to subscribe to your emails or is that just for the experts?
I have some for both. I don't encourage it, but if somebody wants to be added, I will add them.
Okay. Well, look, here's the deal. Okay. Before we get started, Mike, and you want to give us, drop any knowledge on us that you have, Mike is an absolute expert when it comes to use of force. I get his stuff. Quite frankly, a lot of it's over my head because I'm not like you. I don't know all the stuff about the tasers and the ECDs and so forth. So I just have mad respect for you. You're a lawyer, but are you also, what else is your education, by the way? I know you're a very highly educated person. Tell us, if you don't mind, a lot of people that don't know you, can you just tell us like quickly your background in like a Reader's Digest?
Okay. I've got a bachelor's degree in business administration, a master's degree in management technology, and a Juris Doctor degree. I gave up my badge and sworn status about a year ago. I was a sworn officer for 34 years. The highest rank that I achieved was Chief of Intelligence and Investigative Operations for the Office of Enforcement Operations in the Criminal Division, U.S. Department of Justice, and Deputy Director for the Federal Witness Security Program for International Operations. I've published over 100 articles. I've done over 300 cases. I've taught over 1,000 times, mostly use of force, mostly in the U.S., but some other countries. My resume or CV is 108 pages with a 3-page table of contents. How much more do you want? Oh, I'm certified.
No, that's good.
I'm certified.
The first time I've met you, well, at least I got introduced to you, was at ILETA, I think. And I walked in. I forget what the topic was, you know, some use of force, whatever it was. And I sat down in that chair and I'm thinking to myself, holy shit, this guy is credentialed, man. So, all right. So, do you want to talk about anything particularly? You brought up this this use of force issue. You want to kind of give us a little drop some knowledge on us and share with us.
Well, the reason I asked you that particular question is because I've been researching it heavily for the last 3 days, because there are now a couple of circuits that basically say it is objectively unreasonable as a matter of law if an officer shoots someone if that person is not pointing the gun at an officer or an innocent person. And I'm trying to track down all of the ins and outs of that, including, of course, there's other case law that says that the officer doesn't have to wait till the gun is pointed at him. There's other case law that the person can be menacing and then you can shoot them. So it's really a bag of worms right now. And I feel sorry for any officer that gets him or herself in a bind on that issue, depending upon what circuit they are in.
So I remember, Mike, maybe you remember this case. Do you remember the case of the 10th Circuit many, many, a few years ago, where a cop, it might have been Albuquerque, where a cop shot this guy holding a gun to his head? Does that sound familiar? Yes.
Well, okay. That's exactly what is sort of I'm looking at. And that goes into multiple directions. Because the question, the case, one of the cases that really brought this up was the officer followed this kid into a field or into some woods. He had basically held a gun to his head, and the officer allegedly gave him a command to lower the gun. The kid moved. The officer thought he was pointing the gun at him, so the officer shot him. And then the people that are suing, of course, say no, the kid was following the command to put the gun down. Well, here's my point. In all of this, so therefore there was a district court decision that granted the officer qualified immunity. Then there was a court of appeals decision that said no, it violated clearly established law, sending it back down to the district court. Then the district court again said granted qualified immunity to the officer. Then the latest decision about 2 months ago is a 2-1 decision where the two said it's going to a jury for that to answer that question. The other one said I'm going to grant qualified immunity. Now, here's my point. When qualified immunity says the question of the clearly established law that the officer allegedly violated must be beyond debate. If I've got four federal decisions with six federal judges with two different opinions, how in the heck can that ever be beyond debate sufficient to deny the officer qualified immunity? And I consider that mind-boggling in the jam that it could put an officer in if the officer's agency did not back up the officer in such an event.
Yeah. Yep. No, I can totally see that. When's your next presentation? Where and when?
I'm presenting at the Institute for the Prevention of In-Custody Deaths it lists two different issues, but I'm actually going to present four. And that's on Tuesday, I think, October 24th in Las Vegas at the 18th IPICD conference.
Whoa, 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 whoa. You're in Las Vegas when?
I think it's the 23rd through the 25th, but hold on. About this month.
Okay.
Looking, sorry.
Yeah, no, I want you to look because if
Yeah,
if
I arrive on the 22nd and I depart on the 25th and I present on the 24th.
Let's see if I'm in town. No, okay. Okay. When do you get on the 23rd?
No, I present on Tuesday the 24th.
So you're actually arriving on the 24th?
No, I arrive on Sunday the 22nd.
Well, look, if you have time on the 23rd, can I take you to lunch?
Sure.
All right. So I will, let me make a note. I'm in Vegas on the 23rd. I'm also teaching, but I think I have lunch for you. Wouldn't it be awesome if we actually break some bread?
I'd love to.
Man, that'd be great. Yeah. Okay. All right, cool. I'm going to reach out to you, my friend, and then I'll hopefully that works out on the 23rd. And look, I know you're a busy person, so if it works out, it works out. If not, I'll make it happen some other time. But it looks like right now that I have two classes in the morning and at night, so I have a lunch free. All right?
That'll work.
All right, my friend.
Have a great day.
All right, so you too, man.
Unless you got something else.
No, I got nothing else.
Let me throw one more thing at you that I'm working on. Yeah. And there's several of us working on this. It is getting to the bottom of what actively resisting, passively resisting, and resistance triage and imminent threat triage all mean under the various laws, under the various case law, in order to get to clearly established law. And here's why I'm bringing this up. I've run into this three times in the last 2 weeks where experts or a judge basically say, well, under Graham versus Conner, 1989, it said that if a person's actively resisting, well, that's great. But now let's go to today. And what exactly does that mean under clearly established law? And so far, I've got about 40 different definitions. But yeah, these are something. But my point is, these people, I don't want to be demeaning, but basically they do say they're experts, but they're still relying on the mere statement in Graham from 1989 that actively resisting, of course, can justify force. The problem is now you have to define what actively resisting means in today's terms based on clearly established law. So if anybody's interested in that, that is a really heavy subject that several of us are working on to try to provide usable materials and study aid formats for officers to quickly grasp and understand. And if anybody's interested in that, let me know.
Yeah, no, and if you're interested in that, put that in the chat, that if your expertise in this area, I'm not, this is, you know, that's not a search and seizure issue, but I love it. I absolutely love reading your work, and you are absolutely, in my position, in my mind, the foremost expert in these issues around the country. So, and that's why your CV is 100-something pages long, and mine is 3.
It just means I'm Methuselah, and I've lived for 2,000-plus years, so.
Yeah, we got a good head of white hair. I love it.
There you go.
All right, my friend.
Later. Have a great week, everyone.
Same to you.
Signing off.
Okay, so the first question I have, and I'm really glad that Mr. Brave got on here. He's one of my idols, actually. When it comes to that use of force stuff, you cannot get any better. And also, I mean, I don't know if he's taking clients, but if you have, you know, anything that's use of force related, any kind of court case, expert witness stuff, you know, you really do need to kind of contact him. All right. So our first question is from a cop in Utah, in St. George, Utah. He says, look, I was on an incident. We asked the parent of a juvenile to respond to the call, right? So something is going on, you know, with this juvenile. I asked the parent if they had ID. And he pulled out his driver's license and handed it to me. I conducted a background check, a warrant check, and so forth through my dispatch. And then here's the problem. The dad got upset. He says, you know what? I did not give you my permission to run my name. Just to look at it. What do you guys think? Can officers run the information on the people as a matter of routine, even though they're not involved in the crime? Y or N? Yes or no? What do you guys think? Can we just run these parents? Yes or no? Yes. No. Yes. 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 No. Yes. Yes. Okay. The answer is yes. Okay. And here's the way we're going to analyze this is that when a police officer gives you their, I'm sorry, when a police officer asks you for your ID, is it reasonable to presume that one of the reasons that they want it is to run it? Yes or no? Right? Is that kind of like why a police officer would want your ID? In other words, it's not like you're going to vote, you know, and a person says, will you sign my petition? And you give them your name. Would you presume that signature collector is running you for warrants? And the answer is no. But when a cop does it, is it reasonable to presume that that cop also is interested in fugitives and so forth and so forth? Now, here's the deal, though. If you find out, let's say that you are, what about this one, though? What if you are handed the ID and he says, hey, don't run it? What's your move? Can you run it? Yes or no? Here's what I would suggest, to say the least. Do not add time to, if, and look, I mean, I would not, if it's going to be run, it'll just be, you know, on the side. It just wouldn't be, And I guess he's not detained. So I guess as long as he's not detained, I guess it's not a big deal, right? I prefer Joe's advice. Write it down and run it later if you really want to run it. But once you lawfully have the information, I don't see how they can restrict you from using it. Does that make sense? Right. That's kind of like my main idea here is like how can they tell you no, you can't put it through NCIC. I just don't see how they have that power. All right. Well, Brian says, okay, Brian, it says it serves an LE purpose, but that's not the only thing that's, you know, it's also a consent issue. But if you lawfully have the information, I don't know why you couldn't do it later. All right. So Minnesota, cop from Minnesota, he says, can an officer ask a passenger for their identity in a vehicle that was involved in a noise complaint? So the driver here is bumping music. The officer is dispatched to the area for the noise complaint, you know, see the vehicle. Upon arrival, they run the tag. The vehicle does not come from the area. Fine. The officer asks, so the officer identifies the driver. The driver does have a driver's license. So far, so good. He says also, hey, passenger, can I have your ID too? And the officer, the passenger is also abnormally nervous. But let's just, the question for the court is, hey, in at least Minnesota, or look, I'm sorry, under the fourth, he says under the Fourth Amendment, is there a Fourth Amendment issue with forcing the passenger's ID? Okay. Jared says we can ask, but we cannot demand. Okay. So I like that. Can we ask? Now, do we have NERDS is not going to be yet. NERDS is the acronym for nervousness, evasiveness, reactions not consistent with innocence, deception, specifics about them in the environment. I don't think we're at reasonable suspicion yet for bumping music and a little bit of nervousness. But the thing is, what do we have any cops from Minnesota? Say yes. Minnesota, say yes. Or say me, something like that, me. I'm just curious if we have any cops from Minnesota. It's getting a little late there, but all right. So the reason I think that the officer is asking here is that it's not, Minnesota is one of those tougher states. So under the Fourth Amendment, asking for a passenger's ID is not prohibited. You can always ask. The question is going to be what? Adding time to the traffic stop. You guys with me on this? Now we have two cases out of Minnesota. One is State versus Sargent, Minnesota Supreme Court, 2021. And it does say here, permitting a law enforcement officer to subject motorists and their passengers to questioning about non-criminal conduct with no nexus to the initial purpose of the traffic stop, even if done in a reasonable manner, is incompatible with the search and seizure provision of the state's constitution. So Minnesota is a more restrictive state when it comes to these unrelated question issues. Okay. So that's my first thing. You've got to be careful. You know, you got to be careful about, you know, asking passengers about their parole, you know, if they're on probation or parole and what their conditions are and so forth. It's just the way it is in Minnesota. They're just more restrictive. However, we also have a case called State versus Alarcon. This is Minnesota Court of Appeals, August 21st, 2023. And it says, and I quote, an officer's request for identification does not automatically constitute a seizure, but a seizure may still occur if an officer exhibits a show of authority such that a reasonable person would not feel free to decline the request for identification. So here's the way I look at it in Minnesota, don't you know? Okay. So in Minnesota, we should not really be chasing butterflies without, you know, without reasonable suspicion. That's probably true in a lot of other states. But when it comes to asking a passenger for their identification, I think the answer is that we can do it. But you better make sure it's a request. You better make sure it is not, and this is for all states, you better make sure that you are not coming off as demanding it. And you should, even when you get the ID, you should not do what to the traffic stop? Add time, especially in a place like Minnesota. That's the best job I can do. I do think you can ask it, but you better be very damn careful. Other states are not as strict. All right. I want to hear another. I want to hear a question live. So who has a question? Okay. This is what we're here for. We're here to, you know, kind of have this. All you got to do, you don't need a call number. Somebody actually asked for a call number. All you got to do is say, hey, I'll ask a question and then I'll give you permission to turn your mic on. All right. So who wants to be on deck? Think about that. All right. Steven, are you good? All right. I think Steven wants to ask a question. Hold on. Do you have a question, Steve?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a question. So this came up with one of my officers recently. I'm out of Henderson, Nevada. So fire department gets called about a male laying down. The fire captain ends up searching the gentleman's belongings and finds drug paraphernalia. Are we good to replicate the search, or is he acting as an agent of the government?
All right. So, but here's the deal though. That's a very good question, because when we talk about replicating a search, we're talking about a doctrine that we call here at Blue to Gold, cat out of the bag, right? So, but the thing is that the cat out of the bag search normally means that a private person has done the search. Here, the fire department, you're talking about Henderson Fire, not like AMR, right? Obviously.
Yeah, Henderson Fire.
Yeah. So Henderson Fire are government actors, and you know, they do have to comply with the Fourth Amendment just like you do. Now, they don't get a lot of Fourth Amendment training because typically they don't kind of deal with a lot of these issues and they don't really come up. So, and yes, Brian, Brian's like, he's a fire arson investigator, sworn officer. And he's like, we do, you know, absolutely. Right. So, he knows the answer to that. So the thing is, like, I guess the question would be this: were the fire department, were the fire personnel, were they lawfully in this guy's pockets? What do you think the answer there?
I would say no.
What? Why though? What was the call for service? It was a guy that was a medical emergency. What kind of medical emergency?
Well, I believe the call for service was just a guy in the park causing a disturbance. When later on, it turned into that he was laying on the sidewalk, so fire was dispatched as well to the call.
I see. I think, okay, so I actually... hold on.
So originally, when the fire captain talked to the officers on scene, he said that he was looking for weapons for the safety of his guys when they're going to transport him.
Oh, okay. So they were going to transport him?
Yeah.
Okay. So look, was it just one more thing? Was this consensual or was this a legal 2000?
No, he just was unresponsive. Just wasn't answering the questions.
Legal 2000.
I don't know what they did ultimately. I wasn't on scene. Another officer approached me with the question.
Okay, so I think I have your answer. That's okay. I think I have your answer. Okay, so first of all, legal 2000 is for, because that's not what everybody says that, right? That's a Nevada thing. So legal 2000, for those who are watching this, is a doctrine. It's a civil commitment. Okay, and every state has a civil commitment statute. What do you call it? Legal 2000. In California, it's 5150, I believe, but I digress. The point is that we're going to take people against their will. If the guy, the easiest way to slice this, Stephen, is that if we're going to take this guy for a civil commitment, then you are absolutely allowed to search him. And the reason why is because a civil commitment, a legal 2000, whether it's done by you, medical, whatever, is a arrest. But legally, it's constitutionally, I should say, it's the equivalent of an arrest. It's taking a guy's freedom without their consent, right? So, and because it's an arrest, a civil arrest, not a criminal arrest, because it's an arrest, we can search him. Now, the guy is unconscious. I'm pretty sure that this is going to be a medical emergency, right? This is going to be a guy that we need his consent. We're going to take him anyway, because even if it's not a civil commitment, that's a legal 2000 is for a mental issue. But even if he's unconscious, it's a medical emergency. And even though, again, it's not like an arrest, it's still an issue that we're responsible for him. And I think that they could search his pockets to make sure that we're not bringing in a person who's going to be on the operating table that has a gun in her pocket. So I think that courts would uphold that. Right. Now, the other thing is, the reason I brought the book out, Steve, is because there is a chapter in this book called, I call it cause of injury searches. When we have people who are in medical need and we have reason to believe that searching them will help us treat them, whether it is a medical alert bracelet, also their name, Steve. I mean, how many times, Brian will kind of confirm this. He's a medical professional. We put their name in the computer and it's like, oh yeah, we've had contact with this dude and he is allergic to penicillin. So the courts also understand that searching him for this medical information or the cause of injury. For example, you got a guy who's unconscious by the bus stop and you're like, is this an overdose? Is this medical? You look in his backpack and like, oh, okay, there is methamphetamine in there. Well, that could be a methamphetamine overdose. That helps treat him versus he has, diabetic medicine. So I guess my point is that it's probably okay. They just need a reason to do it. But I will also say that if we have, government medical professionals, AMRs that counted in this, AMRs are, our private ambulance. But if we have government actors in this routinely searching people to make sure they have no weapons, even though they're not being transported, we're just out there on scene making sure that they're okay. Obviously, you can see the concerns there. That probably would be okay. But I think the answer in this case is yes, because they are going to be transported, especially against their will.
Can I add one thing to that real quick?
That's please. All
right. So I know obviously under the Good Faith Act that we want to overdose act, if they're doing that, calling us for an overdose, we don't want to charge them for those acts. What if the officer also asks, what if he wants to charge him with that drug paraphernalia that they found on him?
We're good. As long as we went through this analysis, right? As long as the court believes that the government actor was lawfully in that person's pockets, then they can hand the drugs over to you and you can do what you want with it.
Okay.
Right? If the court believes that we have a firefighter out there who believes that they can just search people's pockets as a matter of routine, and my safety is paramount, Your Honor, well, then that firefighter would not understand that he or she has to comply with the Constitution. And the rules, look, the rules are a little, I'm going to tell you, Steve, that the rules are a little watered down for fire personnel. And the reason why is that the courts understand that they don't get the same training as you. But to walk into court and say, Your Honor, I don't have to comply with those rules that Steve has to comply with because I'm not a cop, that is not a good argument. They definitely have the Fourth Amendment because they are the government and therefore they have, even schools have the Fourth Amendment. You know what I mean? So there you go.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Nice job, man. Nice job. God, what awesome that we have my friend Steve from old Hendertucky coming on and actually asking a question. All right. So, hey, Steve, by the way, have you ever been to one of my classes? I think so, right? That's probably how you found me, right? Yes or no? I'm sure you have. All right. Let's talk about the next. Nice, Steve. All right. So this one comes from Alabama. This cop is a, and I would love for another one more. We're going to end off soon. But if you have one more person out there that wants to ask a live question like Steve did, please do so. And it's the best way to try to answer these questions. Okay. So cop from Alabama, he works at a university. Let's see what he says. What's the proper approach an officer can make on a person believed to be involved in a hand-to-hand drug transaction? The officers see what they believed is a hand-to-hand drug transaction. The car pulls up. The person walks up to the car, looks around, sees officers and quickly, looks around, leans into the car, gets something and puts it into their pocket, looks around after grabbing that item, sees a cop in a black and white, and quickly walks off. As the officers approach the vehicle, it speeds off. The odor of marijuana is like wafting in the air, okay? It's wafting in the air. Okay, Mike, you're going to be up in a second here, okay? And then as officers approach the vehicle, the marijuana is in the air. Officers are able to make contact with the person on foot and bluntly asked, where's the weed? The person pulls the weed out of his pocket and gives it to the officers. Are we good? Yes or no? Where's the weed? Are we good, yes or no? Yes. Yes. Okay. The answer is we are good to go. And here's why. So first of all, do we have reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot? And the answer is yes. Also, did we violate this person's Miranda rights by asking, hey, where's the weed? And the answer is no. And the reason why is that Miranda is probably not required under these circumstances. And the reason why is that Miranda is required under three circumstances. I'm sorry, three factors have to be in place at the same time. I call this the trifecta. Number one is interrogation. Are you asking a question that's likely to elicit an incriminating response? Answer this question. When you ask a person, where's the weed? Is that likely or foreseeable? It's not likely, actually. The word is foreseeable. Is it foreseeable that that could incriminate that person? That they could elicit an incriminating response? Yes or no? Answer the question, yes or no. Where's the weed? Okay. Correct. The second question is this a known officer? Do you think that this person knows they are talking to the government? Obviously, the answer is yes, right? The answer is yes. And the final question is, before Miranda is required, is this person in arrest-like custody? Yes or no? When the cop walks up and says, where's the weed? And the answer is no. The person's not in handcuffs. They're not in they're not at the station house. They're not in the back of a police car. It is simply asking a person, where's the weed? Maybe they said, yeah, man, I was asking for some money. This guy has a bunch of weed in the car and he took off. All right. So the answer is no Miranda. Also, I don't want to get into it, but look, even if there was a Miranda violation, we may still be able to fix it. But I digress. All right. Who is on deck? Our last question of the day, my friends, is going to be who's this? Is it Mike? It's not Mike Bannock. It's Mike Cipini. He was the one that had his. Oh, Mike Bannock, you have a. Okay, actually, Mike, let me the two mics. I'll try to see if I can answer your both the questions at this one after another. So let's do Mike. Cipini real quick. All right, Mike, what do you got?
Hey, so I got a question. It's kind of similar to the last one you got, and it combines some of the trespass. So I think I know the answer, but I'm kind of curious to get your input on it.
What state are you in, Mike?
I'm in New Hampshire.
Where?
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Okay. Yeah.
So the scenario is an individual who was trespassed from a property is found to be there and he's arrested. After he is released, he has basically a backpack that was left at that property and he was allowed to go back to the property to retrieve it. The owner of that property stated that he believed that there was stolen property inside of the backpack. Officers that were on the scene asked for consent to search the backpack. The individual said no. What ended up happening was a officer at the scene directed a security guard who was there to check the backpack for the alleged stolen property. In the process, he opened up a pocket and found a sizable amount of crystal meth. The crystal meth was seized. But obviously, you know, unlawful search. There is belief that there could be more at the property. So I guess the question is, can the presence of that in the backpack be used to help build probable cause for a search warrant on the building?
No. Okay. So look, we obviously have a problem, right? So first of all, we agree, Mike, that the backpack was not abandoned, right? Because he wanted to come back for the backpack.
Yes.
Okay. So the second thing is we agree that when the officer said, hey, security guard Wackenhut, you go into that backpack. We agree that the officer did not have at the officer could not have gone into that backpack. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we don't have exigency. We don't have consent. We don't have motor vehicle exception, which in New Hampshire is kind of is a little bit different. And New Hampshire, correct me if I'm wrong, New Hampshire, you guys need warrants for car searches, right? Unless you have consent. Yeah,
warrants or consent.
So you don't have the motor vehicle exception. You don't have search instant to arrest because he's not under arrest in these facts, right?
Not anymore, no.
You're correct. And you don't have inventory. So when it comes to agents, right, like Joe's saying, the question when it comes to an agent, fine, you can make anybody an agent. You can say, hey, Anthony, you're my agent. Go do this and that, right? That's not the problem. The problem is, are the police asking me to do something that they cannot do? Okay. So based on what you're telling me, this was an unlawful search because the agent is not, the cop is not allowed to do the exact same thing that the officer asked the agent to do. Okay. Now you're saying that we found this crystal meth. Well, first of all, the crystal meth is out. We agree there, right, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't see any way to get that crystal meth in. There's no inevitable discovery, any BS like that. Are you saying now if we just paused this story and ran to the courthouse to go get a warrant, can we get a warrant to search the rest of the backpack? Is that the essence of the question?
No, not the backpack. So there's suspicion that this all originated with a house. The house itself, so the owner of the backpack has given very detailed or a good amount of detail on where in the house there is additional quantities of crystal meth.
Well, I'm sorry, the owner said that? The owner of the backpack said that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. After the drugs are found.
Yes, exactly. So that's kind of the crux is, you know, we found the quantity in the backpack, which, as we said, right out the window because it was an unlawful search. The owner of the backpack is saying that there was additional quantities inside the house. The house is not owned by him. He was trespassed from there and he was removed from there.
We got it. Well, we got it. We got the answer. You just gave me what I needed to. You gave me what I wanted to hear. We have two things going on here. We do have something called attenuation doctrine. Like, did the question for the court would be, you know, did this unlawful search kind of cause the admission that there's drugs, you know, at the house? God, that's a complicated issue, Mike. I'm going to tell you, like, it could be six one way, half a dozen the other. It depends what your judge is. I know New Hampshire is a great East Coast state. Actually, New Hampshire is one of my favorites, by the way. Live free or die. When you have a license plate like that, you kind of won me over. But it's a little tough. But Mike, I got to tell you, in this case, there is an easy out. And it's a lack of standing. So at the end of the day, if we go get a warrant for the house, that's not his, right, Mike? It's not the arrestee's house, right, or the guy, the backpack owner's house. At the end of the day, even if his rights were violated, the owner, the occupant of the house can't complain about it because his rights weren't violated. So I guess my opinion here is let's put in a warrant everything that happens. Just obviously, right? Judge, we made this guy an agent. He searched it. He found this. And let the judge decide whether or not it's unlawful or not, right? We don't have to make legal conclusions. We don't have to tell the judge. And therefore, an unlawful search has occurred, right? Just tell the judge what happened. We told the guy to search it. We told the security guard to search it. He found this. We then asked him where he got the drugs from. He said this. We are now looking for a warrant for the house. Let the judge decide, A, whether that's a lawful, but also let the judge decide whether or not we have a standing issue, which will get the house anyway. But if I was the judge, Mike, if I was the judge, I would sign the warrant based on what you just told me.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome, my friend. All right. Now the last person, and then I got to go, is, hold on. is who? It's Mike. What's the last name, Rick? Bannick. What a cool name. First of all, isn't that like the Hulk? Isn't that the Hulk? Last name is Bannick? Or am I wrong on that? Do we have the Hulk coming on here? Yeah, it's Dr. Richard Bannick. Oh, Banner. Banner. Oh, man, I was close. Hey, Bannick, you're like the opposite. Are you weak? Okay, no. Are you yellow? Are you yellow and you're not green?
Hell no.
I like your style already. What's up, brother?
Not much. It's 11 o'clock in Ohio. How are you guys doing?
All right. I do appreciate you being here. Do you have to be at work in the morning?
Yeah, 7 o'clock.
All right. I love you for staying by this long. So let's get down to business. What you got, my friend?
No worries. I appreciate you, everything you guys do. We have a robbery suspect that flees in a rental car. He's pursued by police, but he bails, abandons that car, doesn't come back. The car's towed and stored in the Sallyport. So obviously we want to search it, not only the car, but the infotainment system. What say you, sir?
Yeah. Okay. So let's go with two things. The first thing I want to talk about is abandonment. Why? Now, is he the renter of the car?
His wife is, and it was rented on September 12th, and it was a 3-day rental. The rental company was looking for it, but they had not reported it stolen yet.
I love it. Okay. So look, the first thing, Mike, is that he, let's talk about baseline stuff here. Okay. He basically does have a reasonable expectation of privacy. If, you know, barring any of these other facts, if he's driving the rental car, he gets pulled over and his wife rented it, even though he's not on the agreement, we know that he has a reasonable expectation of privacy from a case called United States versus Byrd, U.S. Supreme Court out of Pennsylvania, 2017. Okay, so whatever, maybe 15. But anyway, so far, so good, right? Now, the thing, though, is that this car has been it's been rented for a longer period of time. He committed crimes with it, and then he left it in an area. And what did he, like, run from it? You said he ran from the police, and he like, left it in a neighborhood or something?
Yes.
I love it. Did he leave, like, just it'll help the case. Did he do anything else with the car? Like, did he leave the keys in it?
Yes.
Oh, mama mia. Did he leave, was it unlocked as well? Probably unlocked, right?
Yeah, with the window down.
And was it in his house? Was it in his driveway?
No.
It's probably some foreign neighborhood that he has no association with that you can tell?
Exactly, yes.
All right. So basically, that's abandonment, okay? Abandonment is when a person does something or says something to lead a reasonable person to believe they no longer want anything to do with it. You have tons of factors to believe that the person is... is abandoned the property. So it's past due. The area where it's left, he has no interest in, unlocked. Keys are in it, by the way, is huge. It's huge. Cause that's really, like, if you wanted to, like, keep your privacy in something, why would you leave the very thing that you need to lock it inside the car? And he also fled, right? So all these factors, he abandoned it. Now, the other thing, though, look, I would go with abandonment all day long. In fact, if I was your prosecutor, and who's my prosecutor here? It's it starts with an M. It's Marvin. It's Marvin. Hey, Marvin, are you still here? Let me see if Marvin's still here. Marvin's gone. He's in California, too. So he doesn't. Well, that's a lawyer for you. He doesn't have the he's never worked a night shift in his whole life like you have, my friend. So, but I know Marvin would probably agree with me, right? But the thing is, now we have abandonment, but also, do you think you have probable cause? Is there facts or circumstances you can articulate that there would be evidence of that robbery in the vehicle?
Yes.
Can you just tell me why, just so before we wrap up here?
Well, luckily, my chief saw the robbery suspect get into the car. Then they started to pursue the car.
Oh, so maybe I missed that. You're saying that the robbery, oh shit, it just occurred.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, you're done. You're done. Okay, look, you're so good here. You're so good here. Abandonment is my number one thing because it's just easy to articulate abandonment. You don't, you know, abandonment is, did the person not expect privacy? But even if they did expect privacy, you have probable cause. You have the motor vehicle exception. And because you're in Ohio, you have the full-blown motor vehicle exception. The case there is U.S. versus Ross, U.S. Supreme Court, where it says, and actually there's two cases, U.S. versus Ross says that you search the car as if you had a warrant. You don't need a warrant. So when it comes to infotainment center, I prefer abandonment on infotainment centers. Okay, Mike? Just okay. So you know, I don't like downloading infotainment centers without a warrant. Because the problem is that a lot of courts around the nation are saying that they are essentially cell phones. However, there is an argument if we don't have abandonment that we can at least argue the motor vehicle exception, because would a judge allow you to download infotainment for GPS coordinates and so forth? The answer is yes. However, I got to tell you, if I was on scene and we did not have abandonment, I would just get a warrant because I don't like them. The infotainment systems caused a problem. And the reason why it started with Riley is that Supreme Court case where the U.S. Supreme Court said that cell phones can't be searched incident to arrest. That's a little bit different here, right? That's not a problem, but incident to arrest. And they start talking about how these phones, you know, have a vast amount of information. You know, there's more information in a cell phone than actually in your house. Maybe be true. Your pictures and so forth are not usually printed anymore. However, it is arguable, but I just, the abandonment is the best one.
Thank you.
No, thank you. All right, my friends, look, it's late. My friend, the Hulk, the new Hulk part two. Bannock is tired. He has to go to work in Ohio, which is, I love Ohio, by the way. Thank you for being here. I teach a lot there. Actually, it's just there, just the other day. All right. So that's all I got for you. Richard, do you have anything else for us before we leave? He's trying to make fun of me a little bit. He says, you couldn't be asking questions more like a lawyer right now. Actually, not making fun of me. Maybe more like a lawyer. I don't know. I don't know what Joe's saying. Joe, get out of here. Beat it. All right. So I'm so glad you guys are here. I'll see you next week. For all my East Coasters, man, you guys put in some work to be here. I really appreciate you. And I'm going to stop the recording. We'll put this video on YouTube. So anybody who wants to rewatch it can rewatch it. Richard, thank you so much. Phil, you're welcome. I love you guys. And I'm so glad you're here. Mike Boone and John Ween, for those two, my co-hosts, who said I could not make it tonight, you're dead to me. You're dead to me. Do not ever come on this show ever again, okay? And if you tell me that you saw this bit, I know you watch it. And that's why I'm doing it. I love you guys too. All right, I'll talk to you.